to today's session on freelancing. We have a great panel on the line, and this should be a really good conversation. Today's session will be moderated by Howard Gold, a columnist with MarketWatch and contributing writer to Poets and Quants, which is a website focused on the world's leading business schools. We also have on the line as panelists Ryan DuRosso, John Kimmelman, Shin Liu, and Rebecca Weber. They are all freelance journalists, and we're really excited to have everyone on the call. Thank you, and welcome to each of you. To our listeners, if you have a question for the panel, you can email it to sabew@sabew.org. That's sabew@sabew.org. And those questions are going to be forwarded to Howard, and he'll be posing them to the panel. With that, I will hand things over to Howard and the panel. Howard?
Thank you, Kim, and thank you for organizing this panel. I really appreciate it. I'm very excited about it. And I think because we have so much to talk about, we're going to dispense with the usual lengthy introductions. All their distinguished resumes are right there in the advert for this. So we're going to just start off by, I think we'll start with Ryan. We're going to ask each of our panelists to talk for a few minutes about their, in general, how they approach freelancing, their experiences, some of the things they've learned, and some things they want to share. So why don't we start off with you, Ryan?
Okay, great. Welcome, everyone. I'm, you know, happy to be a part of this. I've been freelancing about 60 to 70% of my 11-year career. And so the reason I got into freelancing, maybe sort of start there, and then I'll kind of talk about sort of how I approached the business, was just, you know, I was a journalist out of school and joining journalism at a time when, you know, a lot of changes were happening. It was kind of a very screwed up organizational structure. And so, you know, one of the first internships I had, like half of the workforce was laid off, and had similar experiences. I've been at two magazines that stopped publishing, and I quickly found that, you know, my time as a freelancer, I could make more money, which is nice, but also build a level of security, which I wasn't finding in the journalism world. And so that's the reason I sort of, you know, kind of embraced freelancing for the past 5 years consecutively. In terms of how I approach my business, I mean, it's kind of a tough question because I would think that I approach it just like someone who's, you know, in business would. It's all about sort of, you know, what your rate is and how long you're spending doing that and then, you know, marketing and how long you're doing with, you know, new clients and things of that nature. And so in terms of structure, I have about 60 to 70% journalism clients and then 20 to 30%, you know, business writing or other things, clients. And so I'm just, you know, it's a constant sort of communication with people I know, current clients, et cetera, about sort of like what's on the docket, what's available next, and where do I fit in? So even though, you know, I'm just in front of a computer all day, I'm constantly emailing and talking to people sort of about that. And so there's a lot of planning involved, especially when you don't know where that next paycheck is, you know, next month, or et cetera. Is that what you're looking for, Howard?
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you. John?
Hey, hi. Yeah, I'm John Kimmelman. I'm actually both a freelance financial journalist and a freelance content marketer for mostly financial services companies. They're my clients. You know, given all the journalists that are on this panel, you know, Howard had asked me to sort of focus more on my commercial work, not my journalistic work, which is what I'm going to focus on today in my discussion. I would say the commercial work these days is occupying about maybe 60 to 70% of my time, and the journalism is the rest, you know, about 30%. Until last year, I had been a full-time financial journalist over like a 25-year period. And my most recent job, having been with Barron's website, Barron.com, you know, Barron's being the Dow Jones investment publication, actually Howard hired me back in 2004 for that position. So naturally, I will always have a warm spot in my heart for Howard Gold. But unfortunately, good job, John. What's that?
You did a great job. So I'm sorry.
Well, thank you. That takes me to March of last year, where I actually got downsized out of that job. This is long after Howard left, and Howard had nothing to do with it. Just to be clear. But anyway, I was downsized out of a job and decided, sort of right on the spot, that, you know, right after I got my pink slip, that I would focus on other things. That I would mostly leave journalism, at least for now, in the rearview mirror and focus on content work, on content marketing work. And I think my decision to do that arose, for me at least, partly out of a desire to kind of test my economic value in the marketplace. You know, in other words, you know, what can somebody with my financial knowledge and my writing and editing skills get for his efforts in the way of compensation? And, you know, the assumption being that journalism is not the ideal way for somebody in my skill set to fully capture his value or her value. So, what's the work I do? What is the work of a content marketer? Which, frankly, is a term that I don't think I'd heard of until about a year and a half ago. They used to call this area custom publishing. You know, the terminology has morphed a bit, but suffice it to say, content marketing is basically doing journalistic style writing, but in the service of corporate clients. And it takes a lot of different forms. It's everything from ghostwriting articles for executives and asset managers, people who have a story to tell, but they don't have the words, they don't have the ability to tell it themselves, so they use somebody like me as their ghost. I've written my share of advertorial copy. I've written primers on various investment topics for educational sections of various websites like Pacific Life and Cadra, which is a new commercial real estate venture. So it's sort of like almost like Investopedia-styled treatments on various topics, but doing it for a company website in their educational section. I've done a fair amount of those kinds of pieces. I've also written my share of sort of what I would call journalistic-styled articles for Korn Ferry, which is the big, you know, the largest executive recruitment firm in the world. And they're run by an ex-Smart Money editor who takes a very journalistic approach to the world of content marketing, which I actually like, because it allows me to kind of employ, you know, the skills that I have as a journalist of researching things, you know, and then writing about them. But I'm doing it for a corporate client. I'm not doing it, for a news organization. There are these things called white papers, which a lot of people in content marketing write, which are longer studies on various topics. I haven't gotten into that, but I probably will fairly shortly. As a matter of fact, I got a call the other day about a white paper project that I may be working on. And I should add that I've also been looking for full-time jobs in this area. So the work I'm doing as a freelancer is really kind of just to play the field and learn more about this world, this new world that was kind of foreign to me until about a year ago. I'll just say quickly the kind of the pros and cons, the benefits, and some of the negatives. You know, the biggest pro for me is that there's just a lot more of this kind of work out there now, and a lot more demand for my services than there would be if I was just strictly doing journalism. And the opportunities seem to be growing. I mean, there are hundreds of companies out there that are waking up to the importance of using good either written or video or audio content to advance their brands. And so this world of content marketing is growing. There are also PR firms that are waking up to the reality that their clients need content marketing to advance their interests. So it's for PR firms, it's not just, you know, all about media relations. It's not all about just getting your client quoted in the Wall Street Journal or the FT or some other newspaper and feeling that that's what their role is. They also realize that their clients want to, you know, do things like write articles for their LinkedIn profile. And if they've got thousands of followers and those followers in turn have followers, there can be kind of a way of getting your word out using LinkedIn or other social media forums. And of course, to do these pieces, to show their thought leadership, to use a hackneyed cliche, to show their expertise, they need somebody like me who can actually write to help them articulate these things, you know, using the written word. So that's So it's a real growing area, unlike journalism, where there's been a lot of contraction and a lot of bad news. It also, I would say, it pays better than journalism, at least on a freelance basis. As a content marketer, I generally make about maybe $1.75 to $2 a word, which is certainly more than I was making during the few times I've done journalism, and generally more than I get paid by my journalism clients. Although I've had a couple that come close to that, I would say, generally speaking, the corporate world will pay you more for your work. And you know, my attitude, my motto, as I was telling my wife the other day, is I'd rather be at the gym than making a buck a word for my labor. You know, it's just not worth it to me to make a dollar a word, which unfortunately too many enterprises still pay.
I think we'll talk about this more later. A buck a word is kind of high these days for a lot of things. I wanted to just take what you said, John, and move on with it. I do want to point out a couple of things. There is a lot of talk these days in business about storytellers and storytelling. It's a big buzzword suddenly, and they're looking for that kind of thing. And the second thing, John mentioned this guy who had Korn Ferry. I look on my LinkedIn profile. A lot of people, John and I have been in the business a long time, a lot of the people we've worked with, I see them on LinkedIn doing a lot of corporate stuff, working for social media sites, out of traditional journalism, but still using journalistic skills. So thank you, John. I wanted to move on to Shen Lu.
Sure.
Would you like to tell us about what you do and your thoughts about freelancing?
Hi. Thank you for having me. So I am a freelance reporter based in New York. I'm actually very new to freelancing. I just started working as a freelancer in January, and this happened not by choice, but rather because of a series of visa complications. I'm not a U.S. citizen. In the past 6-7 months of freelancing, I have had my share of frustrations and pleasure. I write about a variety of things. I mainly write about the Chinese diaspora, technology, and the trade war for publications like China File, the South China Morning Post, Columbia Journalism Review, and the New York Times. I also write about personal finance for Magnify Money. It's a subsidiary of LendingTree. I used to work there as a personal finance reporter before I went on freelancing. Then I also write about food for Eater. At the same time, I work part-time as a research fellow at Asia Society's China File. I really enjoy freelancing for the flexibility of it, I've been able to write about a variety of topics and work on longer form projects that I wouldn't have been able to tackle when I was on my full-time job. And I found that it really helps that one thing leads to another. I mostly work with others whom I knew in the past or whom I have worked with in the past, but they would then introduce me to other editors at different publications because of what I have been working on in the past. And for example, I don't just do journalism work. I also take translation projects too. Last week I was introduced through a friend to Mai Lin, the architect who designed the Vietnam Veteran Memorial. She had a last minute translation project that needed to be done, and I jump onto that. So I really look forward to learning more about my fellow panelists' experience on freelancing. And I look forward to that.
Thank you very much. And Rebecca, you're based in Cape Town, South Africa?
I am, yeah. We're in the middle of a storm. I don't know if you can quite hear the wind howling outside. Hi. Yes, it is a good evening here. Thanks so much for having me.
I think I'm different from everybody on the panel, not so much about my location, but because I wasn't trained as a journalist, and so my degrees are in English and education, and I started off just teaching writing and was offered a job as an assistant editor at a publication specialized in for educators. So I had that sort of subject matter expertise, and I came in. I thought it was going to be great, and it was an entirely freelance written publication, and I immediately became just enthralled with the freelancers and what they were doing, and I was like, I want to become one of them. And so I really paid attention to what they were doing. Unfortunately, they were all very, very experienced, very highly skilled people, and the publication had no interest in me writing for that publication because they had all these great experienced writers. And so I started pitching stories elsewhere, and I did that sort of obsessively for a while until I had built up enough of a client base that I said, okay, I can actually leave this job and pursue writing full-time as a freelancer. That was back in 2004, so it's been quite a long time. But that from very, very early on, I knew that I needed to be able to pitch really well to be able to sort of get those clients because I didn't have that network to fall back on. And at that time, I was living in Washington, D.C., and so I also always had sort of a base of doing some content marketing writing. In Washington, it was primarily NGOs, nonprofits, and associations, and that has continued as part of my mix of having sort of some journalism work, some content marketing work, and that has sort of shifted over the years. Now that I'm living in Cape Town, I've been here since the end of 2007. I do a lot of pieces that are looking at the journalism work looks a lot at social justice and the environment and travel. Sometimes I'm seen as just sort of this quote-unquote South Africa expert, which I would never think of myself as, but for somebody far away, I can be seen as that. And I'm not a financial journalist per se, but very often there is a business angle to a story that doesn't otherwise wouldn't otherwise easily find a home. And so I feel like that has been one of my real strengths as a freelancer, is trying to figure out how I can find marketable angles, in particular for publications that I want to write for again and again, so I'm not always having to sort of reinvent the wheel and be able to have those ongoing clients. What else? I can also say in the last 4 years or so, I've also added in teaching and coaching into my mix, so doing online courses and one-on-one coaching. And what's been interesting, so this has sort of been a full circle for me back to the education experience. Now I'm able to teach people what I've learned about freelancing, but also what's been interesting to me is that almost whatever I do, it seems like it leads to something else. There's some other opportunity that opens up. So on one level, people see me doing that, the online courses, and so I get asked about, would you like to do educational consultation? Would you like to help us with your curriculum? And then also, because I have the podcast now, people ask, can you help us with our podcast, with the content marketers who are doing podcasts for their brands? I would never think of myself as a podcast expert. I just simply have one. But, you know, when people are looking for somebody, they very often are just sort of looking up, you know, these certain words, and they come up together. And I feel like that has always been a way in which I have been able to get new work, is just sort of being open to doing new things and seeing where it leads and continuing to sort of say yes to things that seem like they have that potential for growth and that will continue to interest me.
Thank you very much, and that's a nice segue into our next question, and we'll get into rates very soon, but I wanted to ask the panel, how do you deal with relationships with editors? How do you maintain good relationships? How do you build relationships with people, and how that factors into your decision whether to work with a particular client or not? Anybody want to take that?
I would say just my gut response to that is try to meet people and not just engage with people via email. It's amazing what a difference that makes. I find that too many editors and too many people in general in our society are just content with email correspondence, electronic relationships. And I think when you actually force the issue and say, let's meet for a cup of coffee, you first of all, you learn about things that they may be working on that you might not learn about just through email. And you establish a human rapport, which is, incredibly important and often leads to much better outcomes than if you just exist as an email in their minds. So, that to me is the most important thing, is try to meet as many people as possible. And a lot of these people are very busy. So it's, for me, my classic sort of pitch is, you know, let's meet for coffee for a half hour, you know, at your convenience near your office. I think that's really important.
Anybody else have any ideas on
that? Well, I would add that when you find a good editor, like, you know, treat them like gold, because that is one of the harder things to find, is just a really good editor who's going to take their time to talk to you, give you ideas, work through ideas with you, because, you know, like John said, like, they're very busy people, and, you know, they're often hiring freelancers to you know, to get content that they can't get, you know, through their staff. And so it's really just sort of like, you know, bring me my content and let's move on. But when you find that editor who's actually willing to sort of talk to you and help you with idea generation and, you know, talk to you about how to sort of approach it, you know, especially on the journalism front, that's where sort of, you know, I mean, you know, that's kind of golden when it comes to, you know, developing your story list and whatnot. On the content side, it's going to make your life a lot easier if you, on the content marketing side, if you have an editor that sort of respects your time, understands that you are a business, that, you know, you're there, they aren't your only client. It's just going to make things a lot easier in terms of, like, expecting things, you know, with a 10-minute turnaround or something like that.
I'd just like to underline that in my almost 9 years of freelancing experience, I think the relationship with the editor is the most important thing. As long as they're paying a certain amount. I mean, but if you have a really good relationship, as Ryan said, and I have three editors now that I work with that I'm, you know, really have great relationships with, very honest people, very professional, capable, and, you know, I'm very hesitant to look around and deal with someone who's not, because it makes your life much, much easier. Let's move on to something about, let's talk about rates. Okay, and I assigned everybody on the panel an article, and the audience might want to look at this too. It's in Medium. It's called How Much is a Word Worth? And it's by Malcolm Harris, and he traces the whole history of freelancing going back to, who was the writer he cited? I can't remember right now.
Was it Ring Lager?
'20s, he talked about it. And he was talking about how the system has changed, and he said back in the 1980s, Tina Brown, who was at Vanity Fair, was paying writers exorbitant amounts, $2 an hour at the time, which is very high. But he says now, based on my reporting, my own experience, and interviews, the current median price for freelancers' work is between 25 and 50 cents per word. Although we should go to be clear, most places no longer pay per word. They pay lump sums that work out to be about $500 for 1,000 to 2,000 word article. And I assume he's talking about journalism and not content marketing. How does that factor into what you guys have experienced in your freelance business? Is it high? Is it low? Is it about in line with what people are paying?
Well, those amounts for me are low, but maybe I'm in a rarefied world because I'm in financial. I do financial work, whether it's journalism or content work, and maybe financial clients pay a little bit more. But I generally view a buck a word is on the low side, which I'm trying, as I said before, I'm trying to get away from that. I'm trying to get closer to, you know, $1.50 or $2 a word. And there are, you know, clients that even journalistic clients who will pay, say, $1.75 a word for a financially oriented story. So I feel that at least I'm in the right end of the business for hourly or per word rate.
This is Rebecca. I would agree that I think that your niche definitely makes a difference in terms of what you're able to command. And whenever I see these really sort of low rates like this, I don't deny or think that people aren't paying or accepting these rates, but I don't think that those can be, I mean, just logically very, very difficult for those to be average rates for people who are making their living as a journalist. I mean, there are places that pay more than that. And they're out there. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you can come in with your first story when you're just starting out and be able to command $1 or $1.50 a word for journalism, but those rates are out there and they do exist. And I think that being able to demonstrate that you really have something that nobody else can get, again, like showing that value to your editor and really being able to show them that you understand what they're doing and how they're doing it differently and how you also can do it slightly differently than any other of their other freelancers, that's when you're able to work on those relationships.
Well, I have to say, I had a conversation with an editor. I won't name the publication, but it's fairly well known. And he actually said that they have people writing like 4,000-word investigative pieces and getting paid $400 to $500 for it. And I'm thinking, really? I mean, that's think of all the work and all the editing and the fact-checking and everything that goes into it. I mean, that struck me. I was kind of astonished. That really is. Does anybody know, and does that sound realistic? Is there something, do people pay that?
No. Go ahead.
This is Shen Lu here. The most common rates that I have seen is 50 cents per word, which is not high, but it's the most common that I've experienced, or just a flat rate of $500 for a 1,000 to 2,000 word piece. The best rate that I have received was $1 per word. And I also spent a few weeks writing for a British newswire to write about straight trade war stories that did not require reporting. That was 50 cents per word. So I've been on the lower end of this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you're talking about those low rates, you're probably not going to last not Shen Lu's rates, but like the $400 word rate, you're probably not going to last very long as a freelancer if you're taking on a project that's 4,000 words that much time and only getting paid $400 because you just can't live under that constraint. But instead of thinking about it as a per word rate, one thing I would like encourage new freelancers to do is think about sort of what your per hour rate is. And so if you are getting a 500 word piece that they say they're going to, that's going to take you like 3 hours to write. Well, your per hour rate is well within like a frame in which you can do that and do plenty of other work and, through a month's time have a legitimate monthly income. But if you're taking on projects that are 25 cents and they expect 3 interviews and fact checking and extensive editing, like you're just never going to survive. And so, that's also putting in constraints with the editors before you take on the project. That's like saying there's only 2 rounds of edits that I'm going to do. And, this is the amount of people that I'll talk to for that specific rate. And with that, you can get your hourly pay, very high. By a per word count, I've written anywhere between 50 cents to, $2.50 a word, but like my per hour rate is always in that, $100, $150 range.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. Was that Ryan talking? I think even though everybody pays per word, the hourly rate is sort of like your internal compass. It's sort of what you know
you're
working at, and for me, I have a minimum hourly rate that I feel is appropriate for my time, If work is going below that number, then I don't feel good about doing it. So having that internal hourly rate is a very kind of necessary thing.
And it's important to have, like what John said, if you are going under that rate and you're not feeling good about it, the work is going to be bad too. So you don't even, the editor doesn't want that situation either.
Okay, I want to move on to some nuts and bolts questions, and we do have a couple of questions coming in from audience. And audience, if you want to ask more questions, please send emails to sabeu@sabeu.org. We will get to those questions later. But I want to ask, what do we need to get started as a freelancer for people who are thinking about it, the practical, the nuts and bolts stuff? Did anybody volunteer to take that? I think I sent that around. I don't know if anybody did.
Yeah, this is Rebecca. I said that I would take it on, looking at these sort of things about like invoicing and website design and social media. And I'm happy to talk about these, but I have to say my real gut reaction is that I think that oftentimes these are things that people procrastinate and do instead of getting actually to the work. You don't have to have a great, you know, you don't have to have a great website. I still do my invoices in Word and then send them out as a PDF. You know, you don't have to have these fancy systems. You want to have a website at some point so that you can curate the work, you know, in particular, if that's a place where potential editors are going to go to see what you've done. They're going to go to see your clips. Maybe you're sending sources there as well for them to evaluate if they want to talk with you. You want to have your own site so that you have total control of it. But you can also get started with a really sort of quick and dirty digital portfolio that has just got, you know, once you've got two or three clips, you can start a free site on Contently or on Muckrack or just have a place where you can send editors to look at your clips. And you mentioned legal incorporation, and I said, oh, I can't really talk about this. But you mentioned the sort of the same method that I use, which is I've got an LLC through that I did online, but I didn't have one for a very, very long time. And, again, I don't know that it's really a necessity if somebody's just getting started. I'd probably encourage them more to dive in and start one of the difficulties about freelancing and making it viable is a resistance to actually making offers to people, to reaching out, doing the networking, setting the pitches, putting together the proposals, and that if you're not doing that, if that's not your primary thing when you're getting started and trying to fill your roster, you're probably going to make it harder for yourself to actually come to the point where you're making enough income as a freelancer to sustain yourself.
I just want to add a couple of specifics. On LLCs, LegalZoom charges you from $79 plus filing fees to establish one. And the one advantage of an LLC, a limited liability corporation, is that your personal assets are protected from any legal action, which is important. And just on billing, I use FreshBooks, and I think it's $15, $20 a month. They have different plans. You get a full report at the end of the year for tax purposes, and they send out automatic reminders for people if they're late on payments. I found it to be very good. I've used it for several years. Anybody want to talk about health care coverage? I mean, that is the big issue because, obviously, when you're working full-time, mostly you have, at least in the United States, you have corporate company coverage. Does anybody want to address that?
I mean, that's something I'd like to learn more about. In my case, I'm very lucky because the company that actually laid me off is actually continues to give me health insurance through a special retirement program, which the union actually, you know, won for its workers. But I'm sort of an anomaly in that case. I would like to hear what people who weren't fortunate enough to be linked to a big company, how they're dealing with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my wife works, so I get health coverage through her, but her her coverage isn't like, you know, great or anything. It's not like a wonderful plan. And so, I mean, I can sort of go through the analysis. I mean, I live in New York, so we have, you know, a pretty substantial affordable care coverage type plans. And so it's really just sort of evaluating, you know, where you are in your life, how much on a typical year your medical expenses are, and sort of figuring out is the deductible, is a higher deductible or a lower deductible worth it for you, knowing that, you know, whatever you choose, you're going to end up paying more out of pocket. If you have a plan I think it's a high deductible plan, and you can still get access to, like, you know, what are they called? The FSAs? Howard, you would know probably better, but basically you can invest in this account you know, you can use it toward HSAs, that's what I'm thinking of, and you can invest in that account in case something really big comes up, again, hopefully if you're married, you could jump on your spouse's coverage too.
And by the way, I'm going to mention a resource that everybody who's a freelancer should look into. It's called the Freelancers Union, and it's excellent. They can download their app. They have a tremendous. They offer health care insurance. They offer dental insurance. They offer liability insurance through other providers. and I haven't really examined it in detail, but they seem to have quite a wide selection in all those areas. So if you're looking for some of that, you should definitely check them out, and they have all kinds of other resources for freelancers too. So it's a very, very excellent organization.
Real quick, Art, just to jump off of that, I would strongly, anyone who's doing this, get disability insurance. It's super cheap, and you don't want to pay for it, but you may need it. And if you get hurt or something, you'll recognize that you'll need it pretty fast. So and freelancers, I mean, I get mine through Freelancers Union. It's like $20 a month or something like that.
Okay. All right. Any specifics on taxes? We have to put estimated tax payments in the U.S. Quarterly. Anybody have any? Are there any strategies for dealing with that? I struggle with that all the time. I mean, sometimes I'll take on an extra assignment just to cover that. So, what kinds of things do people do to deal with that burden?
Well, I was assigned this one, so I can sort of. Like the two tactics I've seen is sort of, when you get a check, simply take 30% of that check and put it into an account somewhere sitting where, it's not going to go away or anything like that, a savings account or whatever. And so you're just building it up, throughout the couple months and then pay it. And that's like, you probably should go to 40% if you live in a high tax city like New York City or something like that. And the other option is, because you're a freelancer, there's a lot of ways you can deduct your taxes. And so you can take your, the amount of taxes you paid last year, divide that by the amount of income, and that could be that's kind of your true tax rate, and then take that percentage out of each paycheck and put it towards savings. The only problem I find with that one is if you have a sudden jump in income, then it'll be problematic because your tax rate could rise, especially if you go up into like the next tax bracket or something like that. And then I guess the only other thing I would say about taxes is, a couple things. So on deductions, like when people start working for themselves, they're like, oh, I can just deduct that. But just remember that you're still spending that money and you're not getting all of that back. So I wouldn't go crazy on deductions, especially since when you're filing taxes, the ability to itemize deductions has been reduced under the new tax laws, and so you can't deduct as much, or you have to deduct a lot more for it to come into play. So be careful about that. And then
really, when it comes to this kind of thing as well, rather than you want to make sure you're complying. I wanted to move on to saving for retirement.
Oh yeah, I was going to say that retirement is the number one thing. But go ahead, yeah.
So I mean, basically, and we can't get into too much detail. You could you could Google it. I Googled. There's a whole thing in NerdWallet. But actually, one of the good news is, if you actually make a decent amount, you could put a lot away as a freelancer that you couldn't as a full-time employee. There's a lot of flexibility on solo 401k plans and things like. You can do Roth, SEP IRAs. These are all things that we can't get really into great detail about it, but it really does, especially I think as Ryan pointed out, if you have a particularly good year, it might be a good opportunity to think about putting away money in the retirement fund, which also lowers your tax liability for that year as well. So it's definitely something every freelancer should investigate. Even if you can only put a little away, do it, especially if you're young, because that really adds up over time. So next question, how to deal with clients who won't pay? I mean, I'm going to have some more to say about that, but how about everybody else? What do you do? What happens when you have a client who's slow or who's, seems to be stalling or doesn't, whatever, for whatever reason, but doesn't really pay you on time? How do you handle that?
This is Rebecca.
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, thanks, sorry. Okay. So I would say that in particular when you see a client that is a repeat offender, right, that they haven't paid you once and maybe you've done the second assignment and they still haven't paid you, to question whether you should continue taking work from them, right? I think it's real important. You wouldn't take on a brand new client that you knew was going to pay you late. And so I see people sometimes getting into the situation where they're running a higher and higher and higher tab. And I would definitely use that as a situation to say, like, I need to actually consider stopping work and using that as a leveraging position. Another thing is that sometimes people perceive it as that they're being paid late when actually the agreement says something like, you know, we're going to pay you on publication plus 30 days, which I see as like a very problematic terms. I mean, it's almost like a variation of writing on spec, because if they only have to pay you once they publish, they're not, you know, that could be at any indefinite point in the future. So I think sometimes people are counting on, as soon as I submit this, I'm going to get paid, but actually they have no real ability to tell when they are going to get paid. And then one other thing I think that is really important to keep in mind is to invoice as soon as you submit the work. I know that there are many people who like to just sort of pause and almost wait for an invitation or permission to send the invoice, that they're waiting for that acceptance period. And I always, as soon as I submit the what I perceive to be the final draft, it's possible there's going to be more edits, but once I submit the draft, I then right then send another email with the invoice. And I've never had pushback on that. Sometimes they don't pay right away. Sometimes it's not going to get processed straight away, but there's never an issue with starting that invoicing straight away. And that seems to quite often have that impact that accounts payable will take care of it more quickly than if you sort of wait for weeks or months before sending the invoice. And you might think that they should pay you sooner because you waited, but actually if you are really prompt in your invoices, they often will mirror that in their payment.
Anybody? This is Jenlu here. I have been very unfortunate that most of my clients pay very quickly and promptly, and I always file my invoice as soon as I finish the job. But I have had one client who hasn't paid. I think I worked for them early May, but they hasn't paid me yet. I don't know if the payment didn't get processed or what happened in process, but I have been bugging the accountant and the editor in the past 2 months, but this has not happened yet. I would love to know how to deal with a client like this as a new freelancer.
Well, even as a veteran freelancer, somebody who's been in the business a long time, I had that exact same experience last year, and I'm going to tell everybody here something that I hope will be helpful. Delaying payment is against the law in New York City. The Freelance Isn't Free Act was passed in May 2017. In its first 2 years, it has helped more than 300 freelancers recover over $1 million in unpaid wages. So here are your rights under this law. This is for New York City-based writers, and I believe New York City-based companies, but I'm not sure, so you really need to double-check that. All contracts worth $800 or more must be in writing. The written contract must spell out the work you will perform, the pay for the work, and the date you get paid. The hiring party must pay you for all completed work on or before the date that is in the contract. If it doesn't include a payment date, they must pay you in 30 days after you complete the work. It's illegal for them to penalize, threaten, blacklist, or otherwise deter workers from exercising their rights under the Freelance Isn't Free Act. Denying a worker future work and threatening to take unwarranted legal action against the worker are also illegal, and you have a right to file a complaint with the City Department of Consumer Affairs, which I did. They have 20 days to take the complaint. The client has 20 days to answer that complaint, and here's what they used to call in the magazine business the beauty part, okay? If the client doesn't answer, then if you take them to court, the burden of proof is on them, not you. And I did have to take someone to small claims court, which is a claim up to $5,000, and before the case went to trial, I got every case. So this law is an enormous breakthrough. I mean, I never intend to work for that client again. But this law is an enormous breakthrough. There are clients who still stall and pay upon publication, which is garbage. They're supposed to pay you on the law after submission. So I would advise everyone to Google Freelance Isn't Free. Look at it carefully. The City Department of Consumer Affairs was excellent, very helpful, and very I was very surprised. It's the New York City government. They did a very good job. So this is a real change, and it gives you a lot of legal leverage if you're willing to use it. And that's really up to you to decide. But, I think some of the practices everybody's describing that we've all been through are now, at least in New York City, against the law. Okay. Let's move on to some questions from the audience. Now, I have a question here from a writer who says she's been freelancing for a very long time, and what she sees is an increasing number of good journalists being thrown into the market with media outlets shutting down and competing for a smaller number of opportunities. And I think some of you have addressed that. Does anyone have any input on that? And she feels that, in general, the advantage of having been a daily newspaper reporter has been a real advantage. Well, how does everybody react to that? What do you think about that?
My initial reaction is, while that's true, there's probably more, writers out there. The natural tendency for people is to want to get a full-time job. I mean, John seems to have done very well as a freelancer, but he still wants a full-time job. So if you're a full-time freelancer and you set up your business in a way that sort of is going to build on itself, then, it doesn't matter as much if there's more people, because they're going to come and go. And, we're also seeing it at a time when, the entire labor force is very tight, right now. So there's going to be times where that's going to pull back, and that will probably open up opportunities, but it's going to be an ebb and flow.
Anybody else have anything to say there?
I was just going to say, I think you're totally right with what you just said, Ryan. And I think that it probably is true that there are going to be, yes, fewer of the spots that we traditionally think of as, the daily newspaper spots. There are going to be fewer and fewer of those. Mm-hmm. But the trick is really just to see how things are changing, what new opportunities that are opening up, the different kinds of storytelling, and to be able to be open and flexible to using your skills for new subject matter and for new mediums as well.
Yeah, I would say anybody who's faced with the reality of a declining market, who's committed to, they've spent time, they spent the first 10 years or more of their careers, investing in journalism, and they've got these skills. They're not going back to med school or law school or really switching gears, but they want to be able to use those skills. They should consider content marketing if they can, if they can stomach it. If they don't mind being in a world where you're not being paid to tell the truth in the classic sense of the word, you're being paid to market the interest of a company using journalistic skills. It's obviously a very different line of work. It's very different philosophically. Some people, some dyed-in-the-wool journalists don't want to do it. They to them it's a bridge too far. They'd rather get a pittance to tell the truth than to make better money to engage in truthiness telling a version of the truth that advances the interest of a company. You've got to decide personally how far you are willing to go along that spectrum. For me, I get comfort from the fact that I'm still engaged in journalism. I haven't given it up. I'm just doing less of it relative to the content work. And I have to confess, it's a concession to reality. It's a concession to fiscal reality. If journalism were a hopping profession, if there was a lot of opportunity, I would be probably doing no content marketing. So it is a practical concession.
Mm-hmm. I'd say my own experience, I've done a lot of work for the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, where I do research, work on research and with professors. And it's not classic journalism, but it's very interesting work, and they pay well, and it's sort of a hybrid in a way, but I don't feel that I'm compromising anything by doing it. In fact, I learn quite a bit doing it. And there are all kinds of little niches like that out there if you just look for them. And, I've been working for them for 5 years, a great editor, and, it's been very rewarding. So, there are things like that out there. Let me go on to the next question. And, John, this, I think, relates to some of the things you said, and maybe some people can address, other people can address this. But this is a journalist who is also doing freelance work while trying to find a full-time job. And she asked, since both of these types of work could be a full-time job on their own, with freelance writing, including reporting, writing, soliciting new clients, is there a system for juggling both roles, or do you just work extra hours per day or week to get the work done? I mean, I guess she's referring to really a systematic full-time job search here while being a freelancer. Can anybody address that?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk briefly. I think everybody should always, you know, it depends on how much money you need to make. I mean, if you've got to work full-time as a freelancer in order to pay your bills, then obviously the job search is something you do with your extra hours. I've been sort of, I'd say for a typical day for me is 80% working on freelance, or maybe 90% working on freelance projects, and then the 10% would be focused on my advancing my full-time job search. But you know, that depends on who you are, how much money you need to be making. You know, I think, you know, I have to say LinkedIn has made it easy to look for full-time work. You know, jobs come to you now because of the, you know, because of the algorithms they use and the keywords that they are responding to in your resume and in your profile. So that's been helpful. On the other hand, the flip side of that is because it's become so easy to apply for jobs on LinkedIn, many more people are doing it. You know, I get a lot of flat rejections. I think it's an algorithm rejecting me rather than a human being a lot of the time. And I've found that, you know, the interviews that I've managed to get for full-time work, it's mostly through, have come as a result of personal connections. It's not applying for jobs on LinkedIn. That rarely works. You know, I would say, you know, one of the most important things you can do both for getting freelance work and for looking for full-time jobs, if you've had a job, use the contacts you made at your job. You know, in my case, the Dow Jones Network has been very, very helpful to me. A lot of the people I used to work with at Barron's, people that they know, have been very helpful. My first four or five freelance gigs came strictly through playing off of that social network that I had from my old job. So, you know, don't be shy about, you know, plumbing, you know, the depths of that to the greatest extent possible. You know, that's been helpful for me both in looking for work and for full-time work. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, if I don't – at a certain point, if the freelancing goes really, really well, and I may give up on my quest for a full-time job. You know, right now the differential in what I'm making – as a freelancer versus what I could make at a full-time job with the benefits implied, is still great enough that I see a full-time job is still in my future, but maybe that won't be the case at a certain point if my freelancing really takes off.
Thank you. I've got another question sent in by Tom Herman. Hi, Tom. He was a former worked for the Wall Street Journal for many years, a tax columnist. Now he's teaching journalism students. And he says, one of the questions was raised by several of my journalism students thinking of becoming freelance writers. How can freelance journalists protect themselves from the high cost of defending against lawsuits? Is there any good media liability insurance for sale or some other defense mechanism? Good question. I did a little search before this, and I would refer you to the Digital Media Law Project, www.dmlp.org, and there are policies out there, and I can't really speak for any of them specifically, but they talk about the different carriers. There's a very good summary on there, and I would suggest that people look at that and also look at that in the context of general corporate liability insurance, which is mentioned in the Freelancers Union, and I think is sort of a complement to disability insurance. I think it protects your business against liabilities, but you may need something a little more targeted because of the nature of our business. So I don't see any more questions coming in. Why don't we talk? Anybody else on the panel? Oh, here's another one. Wait, here we go. Okay. It seems like some people do a combination of both journalism and more corporate brand and content marketing close to PR-type work. How do you, here's a good question, and maybe, you know, John, you've talked a lot about this. Maybe somebody else can address this, and then we can circle back to you on this. It seems like some people do a combination of both journalism and more corporate brand of content marketing, close to PR type work. How do you take on both and make sure in that case you don't run into conflicts of interest and compromise journalistic ethics in any way? Anybody?
This is this is Rebecca. I can say for myself that I just try to keep the subject areas separate. So I've done a fair amount of travel writing, and I could do a lot of travel content marketing if I wanted to, but it just muddies the waters too quickly. I'd get into issues all very, very quickly about, you know, can I, you know, covering this company or not in a journalism story. So I just don't do the content in travel, and I stick with the NGOs as being my niche when it comes to content marketing. I think that's probably the simplest way to do it, and probably just sort of to follow your gut, right? That if it seems like there's a conflict of interest, there probably quite likely that there is, and to you know, be able to be comfortable turning down assignments that would compromise your ethics.
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, I obviously I'm juggling both types of work, the journalism and the content marketing, and yeah, I try to keep the subjects different and use my common sense. You know, for example, I've been writing a lot of I've been doing a lot of pieces that market ETFs that are produced by JP Morgan Asset Management. I certainly would not feel comfortable taking on a journalistic assignment right now involving JP Morgan. In any way, not just their asset management division, but just really anything journalistic related to JP Morgan. So hopefully most journalists are good enough at keeping these things straight.
Well, I think the other thing is depending on the publication, you know, or the outlet you're writing for. I mean, sometimes disclosure is sufficient. I mean, that you also work for this particular company. It really depends how you sort it. I mean, if you're going to go write a nasty story about Jamie Dimon, I guess you probably won't be getting work for JP Morgan. But I think there's a lot in between that where if you just disclose, et cetera, et cetera, has done work for this particular company, I think you're covered on that. Anyway, so the last maybe this is the last question. If we have time for one more, we'll see. How do you get those high-paying jobs that pay above $1 to $2 a word? Wow. Where do you get them, and how do you reach out? Anybody with tips on that? I mean, my own experience on high-paid stuff is just basically working for people for a while, you start off a little lower, and if you have built a relationship, you can start, you know, over time increasing your rate, and they're happy with it. I find especially if you really produce clean copy, strong copy that saves the editor work and time, that really is a good, strong thing on your behalf to get paid more from editors. That's been, I think, one of the main things that I've found. Anybody else have a comment on that?
Well, one thought I have on that is very often I'll get a solicitation either via email or via LinkedIn from somebody who's heard of me. This is usually in the content marketing space, and they want to know they have an assignment in mind, and they want to know what I charge. Now, that's my moment where I can say, well, normally I would get paid X, but my time is precious, and I'm making X now. Maybe I can ask for X plus a little bit more and see what their response is. In at least one case, I got the response I was looking for. So you can, you know, just when people ask you what you get paid, that's your opportunity to give a price that's on the higher side, and maybe they're going to go for it, and often they will. So that's one technique.
Yeah, on the content marketing side, it's really just like evaluating the company. So if a large company comes to you, or, you know, a decently sized company, or an asset manager comes to you and says, like, you know, we want you to do this. I mean, the best way is just ask, because they have money. Like it's just most people are afraid to ask for that $2 a word rate. On the journalism side, it was really about the relationship building. You don't start off with $2.50 a word with just a brand new client typically. Some magazines will do that, but you know, it normally takes a little bit of time. And then in terms of how to find them, you know, one of the best ways I've beyond word of mouth, because you know, that's the best way, but beyond that, it's just having a website that's clear about what you do and the area that you work in, and that, you know, updating with your newest articles and stuff like that, because over time, people will start contacting you, and that just sort of, you know, you get one here, one there, you know, this year, and then next year, you get a few more, and suddenly you have 10, 15 clients in the, you know, in the back burner.
Okay, we're going to wrap this up with a lightning round. One sentence each of your best advice for current or would-be freelancers. Okay, you want to start, Shen Liu? How about you?
Yeah, sure. I think you will have to be prepared to be your own boss and to be the worker who actually does the job and to be your publicist at the same time.
Okay, Rebecca?
I would say prioritize finding work that is in that sweet spot of both being very meaningful to you and that pays well, both in the same assignment.
John? Was that me?
Yes.
John?
Yeah, I'll go. I would say try to find an anchor client, somebody who's keeping you busy with maybe 50% or 60% of your work, instead of working for a dozen people who are each asking for about 8% of your time. I think your life will just be a lot more orderly that way. And if your anchor, if your relationship with your anchor client falls apart, then find another anchor. I think it's important to get most of your work from, or at least a sizable minority of your work from one client who you really trust and they like you and they pay you well and you've got a great relationship.
Brian?
I just say you got to be comfortable being uncomfortable a little bit, because there's going to be times where you're full of work and there's going to be times where you're a little slower, but you just have to sort of trust with what you've built and your abilities and your portfolio that more work will come. And, you know, the longer term freelancers that I find are realize that and have gone through that and have been able to work through it.
Okay, I'm going to wrap it up with one sentence from one of those dead white guys. Samuel Johnson said in 1776, "No man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." So get what you're worth. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Howard, and thank you to the panel, Ryan, John, Shin, and Rebecca. This has been a really great presentation, and I really appreciate the time and expertise that everyone brought today. And that was a fun quote to end on, Howard. To our listeners, mark your calendars for CBOO's next monthly training session, which will take place at 2 p.m. Eastern on Thursday, August 15th, and that session will be on covering the nation's trade wars. Otherwise, that concludes today's session. Thanks again, everyone, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.